What Does Law Mean, Mumu? The podcast series. Hello, this is Pauline Marinan here again on this series of podcasts that are accompanying the little book on law that I wrote for young people as an introduction to the principles of law. It was not written as a comprehensive law course by any means, but I would just say that in the course of the last few days, watching what's happening on the news, it has become so obvious that many of the subjects that were touched on with the group of learners, as I describe them, were now very relevant to what's happening, particularly in the United States, as all of the nations at the moment in the world grapple with a deadly pandemic, a virus, the coronavirus, COVID-19, that is just ravaging societies and taking life at a rate never before imagined by us in these times, almost of biblical dimensions or medieval, in medieval relationship to us in our history, the way we would have thought of plagues taking over. And it's hard to believe that in our modern developed world, we're not in a position to defeat this virus. And as if that wasn't enough, we're now dealing with riots and protests, some peaceful, some not, in the United States, and an extraordinarily inept way of dealing with that by the power in office, and in circumstances where we've actually witnessed the brutal killing, willful killing, ending of a life in front of people's eyes in a street in Minneapolis. It's still very hard to take it in, and it happened over a week ago. But just suffice to say that this podcast is now reflecting on the chapters of the book. It was written nearly two years ago, and we are now experiencing some of those principles at play, such as the threats to democracy, the importance of the separation of powers, and most of all, and covered quite at length in the book with the young people in the discussions, the relationship between communities and societies and their police force, which is a unique relationship, as we've said over and over, and it can't be said enough, based on trust and mutual respect. And it's very hard to imagine circumstances where, having discussed that with a group of young people, these same young people are now witnessing clips on television of actual footage that show police beating people and attacking them, and actually in this instance deliberately seeming to end their life. It's still not clear from the way the process was depicted why the four officers in question remained on top of this one man who didn't appear in any objective analysis of the footage that was available to be offering any kind of resistance or posing any kind of threat, nor was he armed in any way. So it seems quite a mystery. I just thought I'd mention that because people might not realise that, in fact, the book was already written. It wasn't written now at this time when it's happening. But we did touch on and focus on the core elements of the preservation of society, of the administration of the way we run our countries, which is what, in simplistic terms, which is what a democracy is, and also the balance of power between the different layers of relationship between conserving the rule of law and the tripartite organization between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislative part of our arrangements. Those who are in government and who run the country, those who are in the parliament, who are in charge of bringing in the legislation, and then the judiciary, who are there independently appointed under the terms of our constitutions. And interesting that we live in a time at the moment where a number of countries, even in Europe, are starting to, I choose my words carefully, to tamper with their constitutions. Even countries that were renowned for being the oldest ones to have a constitution in the European context, tinkering with provisions that would safeguard the independence of the appointment of judiciary and other such matters, and also countries beyond Europe that are altering the constitutions to ensure that the king or the president is in power forever, it would appear, with no end in sight of their reign. So we're living in very shaky times, one might say. We always have been, but at the moment it appears to be quite significant that the little book actually covered a number of these topics. And it is good that young people are being encouraged in this instance to think about these matters and to consider them, because they are, as we said at various parts of the book, in the words of Seamus Heaney, every generation is on its own conveyor belt, and this young generation is on its conveyor belt, a highly technical one, it has appeared, a highly powerful one, except now, as we see, in the face of a pandemic where a lot appears to have diminished in terms of the power to resist something as sinister as a virulent and deadly virus that we can't see and haven't any way of controlling or containing so far. In chapter 11, we discussed the processes of mediation and arbitration again. We looked at the whole area of legal aid and law reform, and we did that because those are wide subjects. Arbitration is seen as one of the oldest forms of alternatives to going through the courts. And you might say, well, is that the same as mediation? Well, it's a good question, but it isn't. It's one of the oldest forms of providing an opportunity for parties in a commercial dispute to choose a location of the process, choose the arbitrator, and set a time and place for that to happen. And in many ways, it became popular arising out of a question that was addressed in the course of the book, and that is, what happens if judges get it wrong, or are judges always trustworthy? And that's a very important question to ask, particularly in the context now of changes afoot about the appointment of judges, as I said, in certain jurisdictions where that's causing quite a worry. And in certain instances, there were jurisdictions in the world, and they're still there, where there is no trust in the judiciary, where there appears to be a doubt over their independence and their probity. And in those circumstances, it became very popular in the commercial world for arbitration to be invoked, and will be seen to be in many contracts. An arbitration clause will be there to ensure that in the event of dispute on the contract, the commercial business will be determined by an independent person in another part of the world, a designated person. And there are arbitration rules for different jurisdictions. There's the Court of Arbitration in London and in Paris, and different rules prevailing in the United States and all around in different jurisdictions. And so the arbitration will be run under an agreed set of rules according to the contract clause that says that the parties, if they reach a dispute, will enter into arbitration under the rules of the such and such Court of Arbitration. So it's agreed before they start, and people know then what rules they'll be operating under, and they also know that they'll have the choice of the location of the arbitration. But the arbitration moves along when it begins in more or less the same way as a court process. There is questioning and cross-examination, there are witnesses, and there are documents passing back and forth. So in that respect, it is very different to mediation. In fact, in discussing mediation, one would say to people that it is a simple, straightforward process. Truth to tell, it is one of the most complex and complicated areas of work, because it's dealing with human psychology, and the human psychology of those who are in dispute is very much underpinning the energy in the room and the behaviour between the parties. It's true to say that the process itself should be simple, but the job of ensuring that it's kept simple may prove to be extremely difficult, given all of the antics and game playing of the people participating. In the last podcast, we discussed mediation in some detail and referred to that chapter 10 of the book, where as an example of a working mediation, we had discussed the Orange Grove case. And just to go back on that a little, that was an example of not what I would describe as a pounds, shillings and pence type mediation, where there is a dispute on a contract, the parties come in, they sit with their lawyers, with the mediator, and they determine whether the person who has been accused of not paying fully or not paying up is encouraged to reach an accommodation with the person against whom the claim is made. And That is a two-party mediation in which the parties are there and represented. In a public dispute, mediation would play a very important role. Public disputes are amenable to mediation, but they have to be stage managed and choreographed in an entirely different way, because you're going to have maybe several people, 20, 50, 100 people who may be stakeholders in the dispute. So the way it's managed has to be worked out beforehand. And in the Orange Grove case, the dispute arose in a beautiful valley where there was an orange grove with land to one side and the other, and two communities who were fighting over that orange grove, disputing that it was on their side of the boundary of the land and the old land maps, and the other side contesting the veracity of that. So in the circumstances, they had called in a mediator who was then bid, in the style that was adopted was to meet all of the people from the village in the largest available hall nearby to discuss what the mediation process would be like, what it involved, how they would go about the work that they were going to do, and then explaining the necessity for having stakeholders nominate peak parties, a small group, to represent them, because the mediator couldn't sit down in the room with all of those people all of the time. And that having been done, there was a delegate party on each side. And then the mediator requested a guided tour by two, one from each village, of the nominated people, and walked the land and saw that the land was rich. The orange grove was magnificent, smelling of the most beautiful oranges. And then as they passed, the mediator noticed that one of the villages was involved mainly in the manufacture of patisserie and bakeries. And then the other was involved in juice making and making smoothies. And then it became obvious that there was a common denominator here, because juice was needed by one side. And in the case of the people making the beautiful Madeira cakes, for example, the zest and the peel of the orange could play a very important part in that process. And so by a very subtle introductory part of the mediation, the mediator got the parties to set out their stall, set out their claim, making their submissions as to why they believe that they own the orange grove, and then brought them very delicately towards a position where they had come to put that precious and important mirror up to the validity of their case, and also a two-way mirror to see the other side's case and to perhaps appreciate the merits of that. And then they had gone into separate caucuses, to separate rooms, to consider the position as a timed break. And then the mediator was called by the parties to visit them independently. And of course, that visit, when the mediator speaks to one side without the other side being present, that again is like a process within a process. And that will be very carefully described at the beginning of the mediation, when the ground rules, there would be an agreement to mediate, which would set out the terms under which the mediation was being run. But there would also then be a separate set of ground rules to which the mediator would require the parties to sign up, as it were. And those would be basic matters such as no interrupting or shouting over people, and treating others during the mediation as they would expect to be treated respectfully. And the ground rules would then include reference to the fact that if, in the event of there being a caucus between the mediator and one of the parties on their own, that two approaches could be applied. One would be that everything that was said in the private meeting could be carried back, or that only what the party agreed could be carried back, and that before they left that meeting, the mediator would clarify yet again with the party what could be carried back to the other side. So there was never any risk of something being said back that wasn't said back with authority. And so then in this instance, the parties discussed, had a talk, mulled over their circumstances, and by the afternoon in that particular mediation, the mediator then left the parties to their own devices and encouraged a walk outside, a stroll in the fresh air for people to reflect further. And they then called on the mediator to speak to them, the two representatives, the delegated representatives from the two villages. And they agreed, because they accepted that they had joint interests in the flourishing and success of the orange grove in the first instance, but that this strip of land which was an immensely valuable resource, was of value to both sides, and that all they needed to do was to set up heads of agreement about practical matters, such as the harvesting and the custody and the insurance of the product and how it would be dispersed and how the waste would be dealt with. So they had those small matters to discuss, which they would have brought into the heads of agreement of a legal agreement, which would then become legally binding, and the matter actually settled. So it was a good example of a public dispute where people, there are many stakeholders, it's just not one set of people in dispute. It would be remiss not to include or refer to the other kind of mediation that would be in public disputes, where it's described in the technical sense or in the academic books or works of study as relational type mediation, which would occur in circumstances where there is sectarian or ethnic trouble or problems or political difficulties, where very exceptionally skilled mediators go and work with communities that are in conflict, and they approach the mediation from a relational point of view entirely differently, and they do it on the basis that they're in for the long haul, and they go to accommodate both sides, to get to know them, to become very, very close to the difficulties, and they kind of work with them over a very long time. So they will go into sectarian problems and they will get to know the community, building up relationships in an effort to really instigate dialogue, and that would be deemed success if they can manage to bring that about. So it's not something that's done overnight, it's not something that's done in a day, and that requires a great deal of patience. There was an American man who was sent to Northern Ireland as the mediator, facilitator in the peace process in that part of the world. George Mitchell was his name, and he came for one session and then went away and came back again to have a second go at it. But he was there for a very long time, and that was quite a strain on his wife, and I think he had one son at the time, one child, huge amount to take out of his personal and private life, and yet he devoted himself to trying to bring about dialogues that would be meaningful and bring the parties closer and closer and closer together to the extent that they could actually form the basis of an agreement and a treaty. So it takes a lot of endeavour and patience. People say sometimes when they're studying the psychology of mediation that one of the reasons, and people do look around for reasons why it can be and is, in the majority of cases, appears to be successful, is that the parties in dispute, as I think I mentioned to you in the previous podcast, must never fall out if the mediator finds him or herself at loggerheads with one of the parties, which can be done provocatively. It can be a trap set by one side. Well, then the mediation is in difficulties. But if the mediator can balance the relationships that no animosity sets in and balances and manages the relationships in a cordial way and maintains that cordiality. But one of the components has been identified as a cause for the success of mediations is that when the participants begin to look at the mediator in a different light and realize that they are giving it their all, and the fact that they have put their trust in the people and they've committed to seeing it through with them, that in itself engenders a degree of respect from the disputants for the mediator, and it helps to turn the tide of their obstinacy or their reluctance to concede anything or start to think in terms of accommodating the other side. We also discussed access to justice in the wider sense in Chapter 11, and it's worth mentioning it again because we talked about the access to justice being meaningless if people couldn't afford to do any of the things that we've discussed, couldn't even afford to go to mediation. And so we discussed widening access from the point of view of providing people with alternatives to court. But then how do they go about doing that? And if circumstances are such that people find themselves on the other side of the law, they have access to legal aid. And there are legal aid boards, which of course would means test the person who was applying as to whether they were entitled to be given legal aid, and they would be make an application for legal aid in a lower court and then be granted legal aid, which means then that the state would pay for the barristers and solicitors who would be representing them if they were in trouble with the law, particularly prevalent in the criminal law. And it's interesting because people forget, but actually barristers and solicitors who take legal aid work, who are prepared to do that work, are some of the best in the profession. And then it means that people who are accused of some crime actually have access to the very best talent in the country. So it's not a question of people who are on legal aid being relegated to kind of a third-class lawyer, although I hate to use that expression, but I think you probably understand what I mean, but they're just not being relegated to people who would be less able or less experienced. Indeed, quite the opposite. And so one of the things, of course, about the ethics in mediation is a subject that is often overlooked, the subject that I think should be kept up quite high on the agenda, and that is that if somebody is asked to become involved in a dispute and act as a conflict resolution practitioner or a mediator, well, one of the first questions they have to ask is, they do and have a right to ask in confidence for some of the details of the case and who's involved. And in the first instance, of course, that's to determine whether there is any way that they know any of the parties or have had anything to do with any of the companies involved, so that they can make a decision very quickly if there's what's called a conflict of interest. So if there was any kind of conflict of interest, they would have to decline the invitation to act. And then the next question annexed to that is, am I right for this case? Is this something that I would be good at, could do, should do? And so they have to assess whether they would be suitable for that. It's important because sometimes people of a different disposition might be unsuited to a particular kind of dispute, and making that decision early on is very, very important. In many respects, the access to justice, if we take in the whole area of legal aid, gives a certain amount of comfort to people that if they are in trouble with the law, they would be help provided by the state if they can't afford to pay a solicitor privately themselves. So legal aid provides that legal advice and representation in certain circumstances, depending on the type of claim and on the ability of the people involved to pay. Considerations such as their income, what they own, what their personal circumstances are, would all be taken into consideration. So also, I think it's important to say that if we are meaningful about the state of our democracy and that the laws that we have and the legislation that's in place is, the expression that's used quite a lot now, is fit for purpose. In other words, it is what we need at a certain time in our history, and if it adequately covers the area in question, then it would be appropriate and prudent in any country that those laws are always kept under review. And so we do that by having what's described as the Law Reform Commission. And there would be a Law Reform Commission here in Ireland and in the United Kingdom. The same principle would operate. So we keep the laws under review, and that is a specially established commission which is independent, objective, and it's an expert review group that's there to make recommendations for law reform or to make current law accessible to all. And so it's part, in this part of the world, it's very important to see that law reform is an inclusive process. So the Law Reform Commissions provide a very good social justice benefit in that they encourage people, citizens of the state, to become involved in the process of law reform by contacting them with suggestions or bringing out from time to time some of the reports that are brought out by the Law Reform Commission and providing commentary or observations on that. The Law Reform Commissions also issue papers or encourage consultation on certain issues, and in that way citizens have a means of contributing to debates about the reform of the law. It's a very empowering and important process, and it's one that should be greatly cherished in our democracy, where citizens have a say in and also are aware of the way the Law Reform Commission is operating. They can scrutinise that, there is a transparency there, and they can see whether that body is doing a worthwhile job at any given time, because they are under a reporting obligation to provide an account of themselves, to render account of themselves as to what they've actually done. And they usually put a very senior judge at the head of that commission, and they have a number of renowned academics in different legal fields who would be part of the senior level of the organisation. So that's something encouraging, and it's something that all young people should think about, and to be satisfied that the laws are adequate and that they are continuously under review, and that we have people considering the relevance of laws, and they are there to provide an impetus to governments, to parliaments, to actually reconsider, legislators to reconsider any of the laws that they recommend a review, and where they recommend a review, and where they recommend that there be some reform or revision. So I hope that that is of interest to you. It's not just for people who want to study law, but I think it's important for everyone at the moment to be aware of what we have by way of supports for our administration, supports for our democracies, and that we have seen evidence, particularly in the last few years, of how the courts can work and how they can intervene, particularly in that case of the Supreme Court in London in 2019, and prior to that in September in Scotland, where the judges, who are independent, will speak out with the authority of their judicial knowledge and say that some step taken perhaps was questionable. So those safety nets and those comforts are reassuring at this time, particularly when we're in the midst of quite a lot of instability. So I hope that you'll be affirmed in that, and that you'll find that interesting, and that you will keep up with the subject. And from time to time, regardless of what subject you study at university, keep in touch with matters such as law reform. Have a look. Look it up. See who's on the Law Reform Commission. Who's in charge of it? Who's heading it up? What have they done recently? What laws have they looked at? And are they actually a meaningful organisation and not just sitting there wasting taxpayers' money? I don't think they are. There's never been a hint that they are in anything like that league. They've always worked assiduously and produced some very good work. So I leave you with that. I hope you found it interesting, and I look forward to talking to you again. Thank you very much.